Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter, ensuring you won't miss a show release. You can also access more information on the topics covered, related recommendations, partnerships and collaborations that might appeal. You can follow us on all the social media platforms. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce our first sponsorship with Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. There are only two people I know who were brought up in Plymouth and then studied at Oxford. One is my guest today, and the other is my wife. And since I was born 100 miles up the M5 in Bristol and was rejected by Oxford, to quote Aretha Franklin, respect. And after a journey through Midland Bank, Jardine Fleming and Hong Kong, he spent 30 years living in the US and helping build Harding Loevner into the $80 billion equity manager it is today with a preeminent reputation. He's recently stepped down as their chief investment officer, but I'm delighted today to have Simon Hallett from Pennsylvania, and I am here in London. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks, Simon. Thank you very much indeed. It's an honor to be on a podcast, Money Maze, that I'm a fan of, and in the company of such eminent guests that you've had in the past. It's a great honor. Thank you.
Well, let's start with that West Country upbringing. What was it like, and how did it possibly set you up for this subsequent journey?
I think of myself as from Devon and from Plymouth in particular. I only lived there for about 8 years. We moved there in 1966, just before the World Cup in England. It was basically a high school education. I went to Plymouth College. I was a scholarship boy at what was then a direct grant school. So my life in Plymouth was really all about school, playing sports for school, being at school. It was a 6 day a week commitment to school in those days. So it was very much with my family, with my friends from school and being at school. And after I left, it was to go to university and I rarely came back.
And what did you study at Oxford?
I went to study philosophy and psychology, which is kind of interesting given my subsequent interest in psychology from the perspective of our portfolio management business. I went to do PPP, philosophy, psychology, and physiology. But I didn't like the psychology course, ironically. So I did philosophy and politics. So I have a typical Oxford degree in philosophy, politics, and economics. But the bizarre thing is I've never studied economics. Typical Oxford eccentricity that you can get a degree in something but never have to study it.
Well, it might be advantageous for the business that you're in. Now, you then arrive in the city, London, at a point of great change. Tell me a little bit about how that came about and then how you quickly moved to Hong Kong.
A friend of mine applied for a job with the asset management arm of a brokerage company. I thought it sounded a good idea, saw a similar advert, and it turned out, of course, that the advert was for the same job and I got it and he didn't, so he never spoke to me again. The main difference between then and now, we were all rank amateurs. I was there working as an assistant portfolio manager, and I barely knew what a stock was. It was full of people with minor titles, ex-army officers and people like that. But here I was, an Oxford graduate with allegedly a degree in economics, but in fact without one. But we were all amateurs. We didn't really know what we were doing. The other thing was just the sheer scale of it. It was tiny. Financial services were a tiny, tiny business back in the late 70s. And the change since then has been really remarkable over 40 years.
So Jardine Fleming in Hong Kong, it was a premium brand. It was the time where people started to say about going east for the opportunities. But you barely had been there before you turned west and went to the US. So help me understand what caused that transition.
I was actually 10 years in Hong Kong and 6 years at Jardine Fleming. I'd come across the guy who's still the Lovner in Hardy Lovner. He's still our CEO, still my business partner. And he was setting up on his own. A couple of things in Asia had fallen through. But from a professional point of view, it was a huge risk. We were going on a three-year visa with three baby daughters to join a startup. So with hindsight, it was an act of the most outrageous folly. But I always had great confidence that David Lovner, who I not only liked but admired greatly, I just always thought he'd be a success. And I was right. It took rather longer than I expected, but I think, you know, David's been one of the key drivers of our business success.
So your firm, Harding Lovner, has had extraordinarily impressive returns. I think you've annualized at 10.7% since 1989. And on your website, it says, being good investors may not be in our human nature, so that's why it's in our process. And I wonder what you mean by that.
I think maybe this is the other big change about investment management in the last 40 years, that, as I said, when I began, we were all amateurs. And investment process was, if it seemed like a good idea at the time, we bought a few. And if it turned out to be a bad idea, we dumped them. And the discipline that we brought is really the result of, comes back to that interest in psychology, that we've learned a lot from the psychologists about human decision-making. And portfolio management is partly about risk control. It's partly about company research. It's partly about analysis. It's about valuation. But ultimately, it's about decision-making. And at Harding Lovner, the more that we've learned about the foibles, the difficulties of accurate decision-making, the more we've replaced human intelligence by objectivity. Let's call it objectivity. I'm not going to pretend that we're algorithmic portfolio managers, but we are much more disciplined. We're much more objective in those areas where we think it's appropriate and confining judgment to a kind of core set of beliefs. But really, those beliefs are structured around objective data about decision-making processes that bring structure and discipline, as we like to say, to decision-making and portfolio management.
So you've touched on this issue of behavioral biases. And on the one hand, you go out along with many other asset management firms and seek out some of the brightest and smartest potential managers, and then very deliberately clip their wings. And I wonder whether you could just talk a little bit about that.
We've restricted the freedom of activity of our portfolio managers. We've noticed over the years that not many so-called investment geniuses survive with their reputations intact. So we've come to believe that being smart, being hardworking are necessary, but by no means sufficient conditions for being a successful decision maker in the investment world. We've tended to believe that success most seems to be based upon discipline, on controlling the instincts that smart and hardworking people have. Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger have talked about this themselves, that after a certain level, extra IQ doesn't do you any good. So this requires portfolio managers to buy into this. We like to use the story of Odysseus coming home, Homer's Odysseus, that one, coming home after the Trojan Wars, going past the island where he knows the sirens are singing their attractive song, and he instructs his crew to tie him to the mast so that he won't be tempted to sail towards certain doom at the attractive sirens. And that's really what we ask our portfolio managers to do, to tie themselves to the mast, to accept that there are going to be times when markets are going to create emotional turmoil, when there are going to be attractive baubles floating across their screens, and they need the discipline to make sure that they don't react to those apparent attractive investments. So it really is a question of constraining their autonomy. I think that makes us a little bit unusual.
That Buffett quotation that you referred to, I do recollect, he said you need temperament. Now, on the one hand, you're getting great managers and you're tying them up to the proverbial mast. And on the other hand, you need temperament, which must suggest that when you're hiring these people, you're looking for something more than great scores.
You're absolutely right. So it's temperament. This is based upon Buffett's own mentor, Benjamin Graham, who said that in most cases, the investor's biggest enemy is himself or herself. We actually don't screen for temperament. We replace it. We don't demand that people have good temperament, but we have no magic about interviewing. I think it's just that the investment world is full of smart, hardworking people. And the trick is to turn smart and hardworking people into successful investors.
One of the big challenges in this investment management business is managing the winners and losers. I think your success ratio I read is about 53%. But the old adage is the problem as humans is we tend to cut our roses and water our weeds. And I wondered how you deal with failing stocks and how you stay the course with winning stocks.
Actually, that's interesting. Cut our roses and water our weeds. I've not heard that. That's actually a much more literate way of explaining the core tenets of prospect theory, the Kahneman and Tversky work that looks at risk aversion. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Our utility function is kinked around zero. You know, we prefer to cut our winners and ride our losses. It's interesting. We've been good at part of that. We're very good at watering our roses. We're less good at cutting our weeds. We do actually analyze what we're good at and what we're bad at. And if you think of portfolio managers as being able to do three things, essentially, they can buy, they can sell, and they can say how much. And that's essentially the only decisions that you ever have to make. We're very good at buying. We're pretty good, reasonably good at saying how much, but we're not very good at selling. This is something I've agonized over the years. We know our companies well, and that helps you overcome the fear of buying when there's blood in the streets, when everything's going wrong, when everything's yelling, it's all over for this company. That's when we're very good at buying. It would damage our buy discipline if we really, really went out and aggressively fixed our sell discipline. But it's something that we continue to think about. I suspect that it's going to be some low-hanging fruit for my successor. It's still clearly an area where we can improve our decision-making, which I think is great. I mean, our investment process evolution over the last 20 years has been all about finding little areas where we can continue to improve. And I hope that this is somewhere somebody smarter than me can figure out an area of improvement.
Well, given this bias to action, is there a company that particularly comes to mind that you've owned for a long time and managed to win that journey when there must have been periods of doubt?
The company that comes to mind for me is always Nestle. We've owned it for exactly 31 years. Nestle is one of those companies that really rewards time. It really rewards the long horizon and the compounding of apparently modest returns. Nestle stock, it's hardly ever been the best performing over 1 or even 2 years, but it's nearly always amongst the best performing over periods over 5 years. And it's a real lesson, I think, about the value of compounding. I always like what Charlie Munger says, which is that successful investing is just a matter of finding a bunch of good companies and sitting on your ass. Can I say ass on this podcast?
Yes, because of course, yeah, it is. That's I think it travels widely. But tell me, any pushback from clients who are paying these fees and they go, oh gosh, Harding Lavender, you just own Mint Nestle?
One of the wisest things I've ever heard from my successor at CIO, a guy called Farrell Roll, one of the clients, Farrell was telling the story about Nestle, and the client specifically said, why should I pay you a fee to sit on your ass and just own Nestle for 30 years? And Farrell's answer was, because you wouldn't have done. And I think it's a very, very wise comment. For people who claim to be fundamental analysts, to be doing research into the long-term attractions of companies and their securities, I find the tendency of the industry to want to transact the whole time quite disturbing. And I don't think it does your clients any good.
Presumably that tendency to transact is marching in lockstep with this information overload and the bombarding of all of the mediums which assail our senses. I am told that you only have 2 Bloomberg terminals in your office, which I think is very refreshing, but courageous, some would say. Tell me a little bit about how you got to that position.
If you're a long-term investor, you don't need to look at prices every day. They're just the noise. And in fact, this gets back to your lovely example of watering the roses and cutting the weeds instead of vice versa, which does relate to the Kahneman Tversky findings of prospect theory. One of the problems is that we become risk averse in position of gain and we become risk seeking in position of loss, is the kind of technical term for it. The trouble is that if you look at screens every day, on a particular day, the odds of the market going up or down are almost exactly 50-50. But we respond more negatively to a down market than we do positively to an up market. So effectively, if you spend your whole time looking at prices, you will become risk averse. My biggest weakness as an investor over the years has been that I've always been extremely optimistic about equities for the long run. I believe that in a very profound sense that equity investing is a legitimate way of saving your money and that people should start at a very early age and enjoy the value of compounding returns. So I've always been very optimistic about the long term, but markets are a bit hot at the moment. And it's risk averse in the short term. And if I didn't have prices to look at, I wouldn't have known where they'd been in the last 12 months. And I would just plow ahead regardless. And I think it's a powerful message to people that you do not need to look at prices. You should be looking at fundamentals and then relating them to the prices that the market offers you.
Well, you and I suffer from the same malaise. I can say that safely. I want to flip tack.
I'm sure we suffer from all the same malaises. We're humans. We suffer from a lot of similar malaises.
Yes, although I do think we've been in an environment where if you are older and more orthodox and possibly tilting towards a value investor, the world of zero money and all its consequences has been unhelpful to have been older. Anyway, that's a different conversation.
You're absolutely right. We're pattern seeking as humans. And if we have seen patterns of excess in the past, it makes us more wary in the future. And that can usually be a good thing. And I think eventually it will be a good thing. But timing's everything, isn't it? And timing's impossible.
So let's talk about this top-down versus bottom-up. I think you have referred to sort of commentary about GDP numbers or political developments as infotainment, which was a term that I hadn't come across before. We had Jack Edmondson, Deputy CIO at Oxford University Endowment, on the other day, and he said they almost stamp out those top-down views. And yet, your portfolio, as I see it, has been evolving from being much more US-centric to more global, which if I just looked at it from a top-down view would reflect the fact that the US is an expensive market historically, many others aren't. Are you telling me that you have come at that entirely bottom-up?
Yep, absolutely. It's stock by stock. Our portfolio turnover is low. The global equity portfolio, it's about 15%. So we hold stocks on average for whatever that is, 6 and 2/3 years, 6 and 7 years, say. Yeah, it's stock by stock. We own about 70 names. We're investment people. We read the FT. We read The Economist. We read everything. We have top-down views. It's very, very hard not to have a view, but we just try not to have them expressed in the portfolio.
That's very clear. If we just drill down to that portfolio, two things struck me. Quite large overweights in healthcare and quite large overweights in financials. And we've had a conversation recently with Martin Slenderbrook, chairman of Vico, about the difficulty of really understanding what's going on in these banks, particularly banks in Europe. And I wondered maybe you could comment on both of those, and particularly with financials, how you deal with that worry of what we had in Japan, we may be replaying elsewhere.
We've tended to be, at most times, underweight banks. The exception would be in emerging markets, where the banking industries tend to be underpenetrated, where they tend to be much more straightforward businesses. They tend to be about buying that motorbike instead of the bicycle, that car instead of the motorbike, and so on. So the kind of banking that's done in emerging markets is actually much more akin to traditional banking. It's lending to consumers and making sure that they pay you back, as opposed to dealing with complex derivatives, dealing with capital market transactions. So we had a bias against developed market banks in favor of emerging market banks. But if we think about quality, I mean, quality to us means basically high margins and low leverage. And the whole model, the business model of a bank is the reverse. It's low margins that become reasonably high returns on equity through the use of leverage. So in many ways, banks don't meet our criteria, and we have had a bias against them. We all know why there are long-term growth tailwinds in the healthcare industry. It's because the world's getting older, the world's getting sicker, we're finding new ways of curing us. Technology is dramatically changing how new products come to market. The finding of a vaccine for the coronavirus is a classic example. But we tend not to own the very largest healthcare companies either. We own one or two of the big pharma companies, but we tend to own the kind of medium-sized companies that are providing the goods and services to the big healthcare companies. So they're kind of solutions providers to the giants of the industry. And to some extent, that's what we've been doing in banks as well. We tend not to own the big, particularly European banks, but tend to own mid-cap banks in kind of growth niches or in growth areas.
Are you alarmed by both the absolute size of passive investing and its concentration in the hands of a few?
No, I'm not alarmed. I don't think that where we are today that the rise of passive investing at the expense of active managers such as us presents systemic risk, which I think is probably where your question's coming from. I do find that there are some issues involved with the prevalence of passive investing that will create cause for concern if its penetration continues to increase. I worry a bit about corporate governance. A lot of passive funds lend out their securities and obviously receive a fee in exchange for not casting votes. So the discipline that shareholders can impose on the companies in which they invest may suffer. That worries me. And I do worry a little bit that we will end up with one or two mega-sized passive managers who dominate the marketplace. And there's actually been some theoretical work suggesting that having such increased penetration of passive managers will be bad for the competitive structure of several industries. If you're a passive manager, you will be investing in the airline industry, and you don't care whether American Airlines competes effectively with United. You just care that the industry is profitable. Much more alarming is as a business owner. You know, we are active managers. We have operated for 30 years, manage actively on behalf of our clients, and it represents a competitive threat to us. And that's a little bit alarming.
Just staying on that ESG concept for a while, big rush, particularly in Europe, of attention and focus on this. I think the US, with the exception of a few of the very large institutions, is behind, but recognizing that the winds have shifted. What aspect of the indexation and its ESG, if you like, the failure to address ESG issues matters most, the E, the S, or the G?
Well, I think they all matter. The one that I was referring to now is obviously the G, the governance issues, that I think the rise of passive at least raises some questions for good governance companies in which, you know, we are all shareholders. I think at the other stage, there are a whole bunch of issues that make passive management in the ESG space difficult. A particular one is that passive funds, by their very nature, tend to be very large-scale operations. They tend to offer very attractive investment product. But when it comes to ESG investing, it's very difficult to be a serious ESG investor unless you're prepared to take on the costs of doing research. So at a very simple level, if for you ESG investing means assessing the return opportunities, the risk threats from categories of returns and categories of risks that are labeled environmental, social, and governance, you need to do the research, and that means taking on costs. So it's very, very hard to be the low-cost provider of effectively beta, as the passive funds are, and to be able to assess the risks related to ESG. But there's another issue, which is that it's not just about active managers being able to understand the companies in which they invest, but it's also about active managers being able to understand the clients that are investing with them. And I think that there's a lot of ESG investing that requires much greater clarification than it has today, so that individuals who seek to align their investments with their ethical values can be sure that the funds they're investing in are indeed aligned. And there's so much lack of clarity here. At a very simple level, if I happen to think that burning coal is inconsistent with my ethical values and my views about the environment and climate change, I can take several different approaches. I can say, I'm going to invest in no coal companies whatsoever. I really don't want to be generating investment returns from an activity of which I disapprove. Another approach, but very, very different, is to say, right, I'm going to invest in coal companies. I'm going to invest in the dirtiest, filthiest coal companies whose activities I disapprove of, but I'm going to use my shareholdings and the shareholdings of people who have a like-minded approach to environmental issues to advocate for change. I don't think yet we can make sure that people doing that passive investing in the ESG space have ethical values that are aligned with our own. And it's a very personal issue.
That's a very good point. And we had Sarah Gordon on the show, who's the chief executive officer of the Impact Investing Institute in the UK. And she made some very sound comments about the dangers of following the herd. And as a consequence of that, making investment decisions that may not be actually very, very helpful. I think her point was that if you think that selling BP is the sort of the smart thing to do, basically think again.
Absolutely.
You mentioned clients, Simon. Now, I'm reminded earlier in the conversation, you said that you've owned in your funds Nestle for 30 years. And I was wondering if you had any clients who have also been with you 30 years. And allied to that, are clients changing and are allocators altering their behavior?
The answer to the first part of your question, Simon, is I think we have one who has been with us, if not from the very beginning, from before I arrived. We have several who arrived in the 90s, but by and large, the answer is no. This actually gets us straight to the heart of the active-passive debate. The Bill Sharpe article back in the early 90s about the arithmetic of active management said pretty clearly, and I think it's hard to argue with, that in aggregate, active managers after fees will underperform the market. I think it's very, very hard to get away from that. However, more recent work by Professor Kremers, amongst others, as part of the role that I play on the Active Managers Council of the Investment Advisors Association, recent research suggests that there are ways in which managers can outperform over long periods of time, and there are ways to identify them in advance. The problem, I think, is not that successful active managers who can add excess return don't exist, and the problem is not that they can't be identified in advance, but there's a third problem, which is that it's very, very difficult to stick with them. I really can't quite put my finger on exactly why this is. I think it's partly because you use the word behavior. Does behavior change? And human behavior changes very slowly. We're all humans. We're all subject to the cognitive biases that we've alluded to already in this conversation. It's very, very hard to change human nature. Humans, when they get together in committees, also tend to behave as committees. And I have to say that that's not always functional. For what it's worth, Harding Loevner, I think we're in about as good a position as could be to retain clients. We've got a good long-term track record, a clear investment philosophy and process, stable investment team, and not to brag, but we have a good, though not terribly well-known brand. So we're in a pretty good position to retain our clients. And our net, we've had net inflows despite the flows out of active to passive over the last 10 years and every year apart from the last one. So, you know, we've done a good job retaining clients on a net basis, but on a gross basis, i.e. how many clients do we lose, not how many do we lose minus how many do we gain. On a gross basis, we lose about 15 to 20% of our assets under management every year. And there's very little sign of that changing. So I think it's both a positive and a negative. Of course, on a negative, it means that people are destroying value by selling at the bottom and buying at the top. And I have to say that, again, our experience has been that we tend to lose clients during periods of rocky underperformance. And to get back directly to your question, there's some sign of self-awareness. Clients never fire us because our performance is bad, certainly never because our short-term performance is bad. But when short-term performance is bad, we always lose more clients than when our short-term performance is good. So the signs are that short-term performance, I'm afraid, still drives even institutional client fund flow.
We continue to make very bad decisions, but we're very polite in the way that we pass the news on.
It's partly polite. And I think it's also self-awareness that this is not necessarily the right thing to be doing. So self-awareness, of course, is the first stage to recovery. And, you know, I'm hopeful that there will be, that as the knowledge of these behavioral flaws becomes more prevalent, that eventually more people will change their own behavior. But changing human behavior is very, very difficult.
Thank you. I think I'm right in saying that over the 30 years you've been at Harding Loevner, during bear phases, assets under management have halved three times. And my question is, how have you hung in there?
I think we recognized early on that hanging in there was critical. Today, I think somewhere between 35 and 40 members of the firm are equity owners, or the equivalent of equity owners in a partnership. And that's helped protect us from the bad times. So it is actually the case that despite assets under management and therefore revenues falling in half three times over the life of the firm, we've never laid anybody off in order to save costs. It's just been very, very conservative financial management and staff, I think, that accept the variability of short-term compensation in exchange for relative security job and a relatively attractive, very long-term approach. So our people have really taken a long-term approach to their careers with us. And that's obviously benefited the people who've been around a long time, but it's obviously benefited the firm and its clients as well.
So Harding Loevner is partially owned now by AMG, Affiliated Managers Group, and I'm just intrigued at what that has done for your business.
When we started talking to them back in 2007, one of the reasons we wanted to sell was that we'd gone from being, you know, $1 billion assets under management business to a $6 or $7 billion assets under management business in quite a short time, 6 or 7 years. And we could feel ourselves as business owners becoming risk averse in ways that we were worried would damage the business and would actually damage client portfolios as well. We need to take active risk in our portfolios. You don't generate excess returns by being closet index huggers. We entered the business, none of us, as wealthy individuals. And all of a sudden, we were starting to have reasonable size balance sheets, but completely undiversified balance sheets. We believe in the value of diversification. I talked about the value of diversification in today's markets by investment in banks. And we wanted to diversify our personal balance sheets. We basically said, you know, we were absolutely frank with AMG. We want some of your cash. We did that. We put some liquidity in our balance sheets. But of course, our balance sheets continued as we continued to grow to be dominated by our holdings in the business. But AMG brought us that personal financial stability that enabled us to get on with what we enjoyed doing, which was running an investment business and running investment portfolios. They've been helpful to us in other ways, in global distribution. We didn't have any marketing outside the United States, and in fact, still have none. So we've been relying mostly on them. It's been a very good relationship. The great thing about AMG is that they're every fund manager's dream, and I don't have to say that. They have no possible comeback to me. But, you know, they give you cash and then they leave you alone. And it's extraordinary arrogant of investment managers or any company being acquired to say, yeah, we want your cash, but we then want to carry on doing things our own way. But that's actually what they do. So it's been a fantastic relationship, from certainly from my perspective.
So let's cross from the US to the UK and from investing to sport. Let's talk about football. One of your more interesting investment decisions has been to become the owner of Plymouth Argyle. I believe the club takes its nickname, which is the Pilgrims, from the English religious group that set sail for the New World in 1620. And I think your crest, the Mayflower, was obviously the ship that carried the Pilgrims to Massachusetts. But I was talking to Chris Manson, who ran Chelsea under Matthew Harding. And when I told him we were having a conversation with you and you bought Plymouth Argyle, he said, good luck with that. Was this a hard-nosed investment decision, or was this a romantic journey to your birthplace?
Romantic journey to my birthplace. Absolutely no question. At root, I'm a stock picker and an investment analyst, and we all know that the value of a security is the value of the cash flows associated with it, discounted at the appropriate rate. There are no cash flows associated with a football club, certainly not to shareholders. If ever I paid myself a dividend out of the profits of profit. Well, first of all, let's get to a point where there are profits. And if I then paid myself a dividend, there would be a riot and I'd be the least popular person in Devon and Cornwall. So football clubs have no value to me as an investment analyst. They're vanity assets, they're emotional assets, and they're just great fun. I mean, I own my boyhood. You can see our main stand behind me, and I used to sit at the end that's orthogonal to the stand with the E. I used to stand up there. It was before they were all-seater stadiums. So this is every football fan's dream. And I'm having a blast, I have to say.
But I want to get a little bit more serious, because I think you're being somewhat self-effacing, is that obviously Michael Lewis wrote Moneyball. In fact, I had an exchange with Michael Lewis this past weekend, and hopefully he is going to come on the show. But he obviously showed that hard-nosed disciplines and data can change things. So just tell us how you're taking that and applying it to the team.
Yeah, well, this is the direct parallel to what we've done, Harding Loevner, in investment processes. You know, people are biased, believe in their gut instincts. People recognize patterns that may not exist. People extrapolate from recent results. People confuse luck with skill. People look at results. They don't look at process. All these biases you see aplenty in football. So we've got a very good CEO at Plymouth Argyle. We've got a very good manager, a good football team. And I actually don't get involved, like most club chairmen, I don't get involved in the minutiae day to day. But the one thing that I've said is non-negotiable is that we're going to become more objective, that you people, just like my portfolio managers, are going to have to tie yourself to the mast, and we're going to have to become more objective, more data analytic, more process oriented. And I was all ready for the kind of backlash that Michael Lewis described Billy Beane having at the Oakland Athletics back in the late 90s, early 2000s. I've been very pleasantly surprised that we've actually made much greater progress over just in the last 6 months than I'd expected, and arguably even more than I'd hoped for. So our goal is going to become a lookalike Harding Loevner, but playing football instead of making investment decisions. And we're making good progress. At Harding Loevner, it took years to get people to embrace this. Every week I get astonished by some new parallel between investment management and running a football club. And it really revolves around this core of decision-making. First thing you do in football is assemble a portfolio. And it has to be a properly diversified portfolio with each member fulfilling a specific function. You couldn't just go out and rank the best footballers in the world and best footballers that you could afford, let's say, and take the top 11 from that ranking, because you'd end up with a team of goalkeepers. So you're constructing a portfolio based upon a limited budget where you're trying to identify what somebody is worth and then comparing that to what their price is. And it's a market that's desperately inefficient, very opaque, and where there really isn't this concept of value. There isn't this concept that a player has a price, but that is different from his value. So trying to get a grip on that is really, really interesting problem.
So maybe you give me an example of how you use the portfolio analytics practically. I think you've written something about penalty taking, and maybe you could just shed some light on that.
So penalty taking is a very good example. I think 79% of penalties turn into goals. The optimal place to kick them is actually straight down the middle of the goal, which is counterintuitive because that's where the goalkeeper stands. But the goalkeeper is biased by the action bias. So goalkeepers almost inevitably dive one way or the other. And again, if you want to think about this reaction, think about what your reaction as a fan would be. You're standing behind the goal and the goalkeeper just stands in the middle, and the player just passes the ball to his right, and the goalkeeper doesn't move. You're furious. The goalkeeper didn't do anything. Whereas if he dives right and the ball's kicked right and just missed it, great effort. If he dives left and the ball's kicked right, bad luck, he guessed wrong. But if he just stands in the middle and he guesses wrong, he looks a complete idiot because we're biased towards action. In fact, he's doing the most sensible thing. And because of the action bias, it turns out the best place to place the penalty is straight down the middle. And I've actually observed over the last couple of years, more and more players kick it straight down the middle and the goalkeeper's almost hitting his head against one of the posts.
Okay, well, let's move to some more general questions. You've had this fascinating journey at the epicenter of finance. Who's the most interesting person you've met in this business career?
The person whose name flashed through my mind immediately was Michael Moberson. He actually is a friend of one of my partners, and I've become acquainted with him a bit over the years. So Michael Moberson has written about the intersection of both sports and decision-making and investment management and decision-making. And I find him fascinating to read, wonderful to meet. I'm very envious of Columbia Business School students who see his security analysis course. And he's been the most influential on our investment process. I hope he doesn't hear this podcast.
I hope he does.
And everything I know about running an investment process, you can buy collective works of Michael Moberson for $50, and I recommend you do. Everything I've learned is somewhere in his books.
Why do you think Americans have generally been successful in developing large financial services businesses versus some of the other countries that might come to mind?
I think it's scale and regulation. They don't have to go outside their own country to develop their scale. So they're already operating at very large scale before they go abroad. Whereas even for Deutsche Bank, now Deutsche Bank's been operating abroad since 1870s, I think, and it's never been terribly successful. It's come close to once or twice, but it dominates its domestic marketplace and it thinks that that domination can be translated into scale outside. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. So, you know, the big American banks are big in their own right before they start going abroad. And I think that gives them a lot of cushion to take the kind of risks that they need without jeopardizing what's going on back at home.
What would be your advice to a 20-year-old Simon Hallett?
Stay the course. And I think that the biggest advice you can give any young person is be patient, because they're not patient. And just to keep hammering home to them the value of surviving. One of the reasons Harding London has been successful, sounds trite or a trivial observation, but I don't think it is that one of the reasons we've been successful is that we've survived. Survivorship bias and hindsight bias kind of add up to making it seem clear that we were going to survive, but it really wasn't. And above all, if you're going to be in financial services, keep your nose clean. There is absolutely no need to do anything that is dodgy in this business. The financial rewards are obviously great, and financial rewards tend to tempt people, but the intellectual pleasure that you can have from being in this business, there are very few businesses where you can get great intellectual stimulation, great intellectual challenge and enjoyment, and get financial rewards that come from hanging around a long time. So don't get too greedy either, would be my advice.
And Simon, tell me, when you're not going to work and you have a free day, what's your perfect day?
Well, I've had perfect days almost every day for the last year. I've hardly left my house. I spend time on football-related things. So this morning, I got up at 5:30 and had a meeting of League One clubs with my CEO and chairman and CEOs from other clubs in League One. I then had some Harding Lovenet stuff to do. I then made a call to one of our aged fans in Plymouth. We have a program of calling them up to overcome loneliness. I'm very proud that Argyle has a reputation of being a very effective club in the community. We have a very active community trust that's associated with us. So I did that this afternoon. I'll do some Harding Lovenet stuff. Then I'll get ready to cook dinner and I will have an Italian lesson. I will play my harmonica.
Oh my gosh.
Have an early dinner and then spend 4 hours reading until I fall asleep. It's a great day.
Wow, Simon, that's very different from mine. Well, that's been a terrific conversation. You have given a piece of advice that I'm going to repeat because I think it is stunningly obvious but never said, and that is keep your nose clean. And it's not just for financial services, but it's just really good advice. Secondly, that if one wants to get up that investment curve, you need to go and buy, if not for $50, some of the works of Michael Mauvoisin. And thirdly, because persistence is so important, that simple advice also of staying the course and being patient. So I think those are wise, wise words, and I thank you for them. And I thank you for your time today, Simon. It's been a terrific journey crossing the Atlantic and crossing disciplines, but at the heart, I've learnt a lot, and so thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That was great.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.